You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You're listening to the world's smartest podcast network.
When I go to Sacramento, I will pump up Sacramento.
Some say the news is fake. Others say it's real. These two don't have the time to check. Instead, Turner Sparks and Michael Ira Kaplan turn to comics stationed around the globe to be their eyewitness reporters so that you can know what's really going on. This is Lost in America.
All right, everybody, welcome to Lost in America, episode 314. My name's Turner Sparks.
I am Mordechai Ben Yehuda Kaplan.
Yes. I feel like I need a Hebrew name for this episode.
In the next hour, we're going to get you a Hebrew name.
We're going to do one. By the end of the episode, I will have a Hebrew name. You can find me at Turner Sparks on Instagram. You can find Kaplan at Cap in America on all social media platforms. Today, we have our good friend Daniel Pomerantz back on the show. So, we're talking about everything that everyone has been talking about in the past week, which is everything that's going on in Israel right now and Gaza and the whole thing. But what we're going to do is focus on Dan and his personal story. I feel like the news in this, Kaplan, normally what we do on this show is we bring our audience a story that they know nothing about. Wait, what? There was a coup in Sri Lanka?
There's a place called Armenia. I didn't know that. There's actually a country.
Tell me about this place. Who are these fairy tale human beings? And so we usually go through the, this is who the prime minister is. This is what's happening in the elections. This is what these events just happened. We go through the beats, the actual nuts and bolts beats of the story. This week, complete opposite. You can get this story literally anywhere at any time. You can get the overall beats of the story. We're going personal today.
It would be impressive if you didn't know the beats of the story. You an impressive amount of stupidity or apathy or whatever you want to use the word.
There was a guy, I think I've told you this story, Kaplan, but on the day of voting 2020, the Biden-Trump election day, everyone in planet Earth was talking about this election. Definitely everyone in Brooklyn, New York was talking about this election. I was standing in line to vote. This dude skateboards by. He's like a white guy with dreadlocks. One of those dudes. He skateboards by and he goes, what is going on?
Is there a new cupcake place? What's his line?
And I go, he comes up to, he just skates up to me. He goes, what is going on? And I was like, today's, we're voting in the president. He goes, oh, that election thing's today. I'm like, I wish I was you. I wish I didn't know anything about this. And if there is someone on planet Earth who's somehow listening to our podcast and has never heard of this story, it's almost enviable.
Yeah, it's a great position to be in.
Be so unplugged from planet Earth to not know. But no, I assume most of our people know. We also were talking about who we should get on a guest to talk about this story. And we decided a friend of ours, Let's have someone we know, because this is ultimately, this is personal. It's human. And we want Dan on here. So Dan will be on with us in just a minute. But before that, Kaplan, patreon.com/lostinamerica. If you want to support our show, we put this out for free every single week. We've been doing it for 7 years now. And every week. And so to support us, to let us keep doing the show, to continue this show, go to patreon.com/lostinamerica. Throw us $5 a month and we will read your name next week on the show. We will thank you on the air. You will also get access to our Lost in the Bunker is the name of the show. I almost said live in the bunker. Lost in the Bunker, Full Throttle Comedy Podcast show. That's me and Kaplan. Making comedy about absolutely anything that's going on in the world.
Including this story, because this Thursday I'm co-hosting with my rabbi a vigil here in Long Island City for the victims of this horrible terrorism attacks we're going to talk about in a moment. And, you know, not to make comedy of it, but I've got some local politicians who are heading for the hills who don't want to show up. So we will
Dox
them on that show. Yeah, there was one politician who said, I'd love to come, but my wife is due. And we looked it up. His wife is due in December. So he's just making
it.
Apparently, he's on 24/7.
Hot button of an issue for this guy.
Yeah.
I think our good friend, Dr. Andrea Jones-Roy, just sent us a study. I don't know if it was in the New York Times or where, but it essentially said they went through every category. They polled Americans on what they thought on this topic, and 90%. Essentially sided with, 94% sided with innocent people should not be dead. There were 6% who thought that, the Israeli people should die. 6% of America.
Right.
That alone was enough to get, universities.
I don't think it.
Your local politicians to be like, I don't know. It's too divisive. 92 to 94.
They're worried about that 6%.
Yeah, they're worried about that 6%.
They show up.
I also, before we get on to this, we were talking off air about, is there anything funny going on here? Dan was concerned that he didn't want to, come on. He was like, I'm not, and this might not be as funny as previous episodes. I found, and maybe we'll bring Dan in for this one. Why don't we bring Dan in, everybody?
Yeah,
and then I'll get to it. Daniel Pomerantz, what we know about, normally we would say, what do we get right? What do we get wrong? What do we know about this topic? Yeah, we're skipping all that. Daniel Pomerantz, you can he is the CEO of Reality Check Research. Check that out, everybody. You can find him on Instagram at Daniel Speaks Up. He's been putting out a lot of great stuff
about videos
about what's going on recently. Daniel, welcome to the show. Daniel's in Tel Aviv right now at his home in Tel Aviv. Thank you for coming back to the show. And it was great to see you a few months ago in New York City. How you doing?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me. I saw you at the New York Comedy Club. Mike brought me out. You were hosting. It was a great show, a good night. And, when Mike first started talking to me about what's going on here, I mentioned that I was doing some work for Israel's Ministry of Public Diplomacy, helping them get speaking points and stuff together. And Mike said, do they need any jokes?
Yes.
And my first thought was, it's something we need. Like, I don't know how you find humor at a time like this, but if you could, like, our souls just need it right now. So if we find a way to do that, like, good for us.
Let's get to you. So I want to start with just your story. October 7th. Where were you when all this, how did this news hit you?
I woke up. I live in Tel Aviv. So I woke up in my bed in Tel Aviv. First thing I do after I wake up, brush my teeth. I do a meditation every morning. So I'm doing my meditation and I hear very faintly the sound of sirens. Sometimes you hear the sirens really loud if they're like right next to you. But sometimes if it's in like a neighboring area, it might sound a little softer. But, when you hear it, you still go to the bomb shelter. Usually when you hear a siren, there's a context, that like tensions have been ramping up, something's going on. And then the sirens start, a few days later, that's usually how it happens. So when I heard this, I'm in the middle of my meditation. I'm like, that sounds like a siren. And then I'm like, that is a siren. And suddenly the thoughts clicked in my head one after another. The first thought is that's a siren. The second thought is there's no context around this because there weren't tensions ramping up. The third thought is everything's just changed. And I got that in an instant just from that little sound. So I wake up, I go to the bomb shelter. You're supposed to wait there for 10 minutes. the Iron Dome, which is the missile shield, does its thing to knock down the missiles. It doesn't knock down all of them. So, you know, you still have to go be safe. It's sort of like driving in a car. You don't think you're going to crash, but you wear your seatbelt. And then after that, I checked out the news because I'm thinking, well, I want to understand what just happened here. And there were images of Hamas fighters. And, you know, they're a terror group, but these guys are, you know, they're not like, you know, people who wear in rags and living in a cave. They're like, you know, very well trained. We think they were trained by Iran. If you look at them, they look like any regular special forces group with all the gear and stuff. And they were in a pickup truck driving on streets through Israeli towns. And some people were getting it on their cell phones and sending it to the news channels. And that's something, you know, you don't see. That's like, imagine if like Al-Qaeda or ISIS was like driving down Fifth Avenue in, you know, with full gear and weaponry. Like, and I saw that and I was just like, yeah, this is, we've just entered a new reality right here. And then right after that, everything started catching up. And from there, it's a very nine, you know, on 9/11, I was in New York. I was working at 59th and 5th, so I was not close enough to be in it, but still close enough to see the smoke and to feel, you know, at the time, nobody knew what was going to happen. We didn't know, is this going to spread to other buildings? Is it going to be all over? So there was no sense of like, well, that's down on Wall Street and I'm here. Like it was, you didn't know, but you did know that you'd grown up with this reality that America is the strongest country in the world. Nobody can attack us at home. And that reality got shattered. And we all felt this sense of insecurity because nobody knew what was happening or about to happen. And our thoughts about our America, our country and our safety had suddenly changed. And it was exactly that kind of feeling all over again. Like you just don't know. And you're not sure if you feel safe even in your own home. And that was the beginning of it. I mean, there's a lot more to tell, but that was the beginning, those events and that shift in feeling.
What strikes me immediately as a complete outsider in all this is how casually you just mentioned going to your bomb shelter.
Yeah.
So I think most places in the world, people don't just casually have a bomb shelter. Is that a normal way of life?
It is actually, sadly, but all buildings here are required to be built with bomb shelters, and there's specs, construction specs on how they have to be built and what they need to be able to withstand. I'm fortunate to live in a modern building where the bomb shelters are very good, and they even have equipment in there for protection against biological and chemical attacks. I don't know if you guys remember that in 1991, Saddam Hussein was firing Scud missiles. And at the time, the intelligence was saying they might be tipped with chemical weapons. So everyone was worried about that, and everyone had their gas masks and, Gulf War. So that hasn't been an issue in a while, but we do have the equipment in the bomb shelter for that. And it was really cute. My friends in America, like you guys, were asking questions. So I made a little video. I'll actually send it to you guys. You can share it with the pod if you like. Video of me, when a siren went off and I said, all right, I'm in my house. The siren's gone off. I'm going to go over to the bomb shelter now and you're going to come with me and, you know, follow me in. And we get to the bomb shelter and people have their dogs there because you take the dog with you because, you know, if something happens, you don't want the dog in your apartment where they're dangerous. And my friends who are who have kids, they were telling me their kids were just so relieved to see that the dogs were in the shelter because that's what they were most worried about in Israel is who's taking care of the dogs. And just something about seeing the world through the eyes of kids, you know.
Sure.
But the way it works is you have Israel has this massive system of radars that detects a launch and immediately calculates the trajectory. So the moment it's launched, it automatically sets off an alarm in the place in the country where it's heading. So it launched from Gaza a few seconds ago, but instantly in Tel Aviv, which is 60 kilometers away, you already have sirens. And not just in Tel Aviv, but in the right part of Tel Aviv. So it's very accurate.
Really?
From Tel Aviv, you have 90 seconds before the rocket gets here. So that's how much time I have from when I hear the siren to get to the bomb shelter.
Where is the bomb shelter? Is it, God, you got it? How fast is it to get it there from your building? Like what floor are you on or what floor is the...
Well, in my building, I live in a high rise. We have bomb shelters on every floor.
Oh, every floor. Okay.
And basically the core of the building, which has the elevators, is built to be able to withstand this stuff. And so that core includes on every floor these bomb shelters. Like theoretically, you could blow up the building and the core would stay standing. I mean, I guess it depends on what you hit the building with, but that's up to a certain tolerance, it should be able to handle
you,
that.
You don't need like a key fob or anything to get into that. Like everyone can just.
No, no. Just in fact, we keep the door during peacetime. You know, they close the doors. In some people's homes, they use it as like a storage for bicycles and stuff.
Right,
but they actually keep the door open so that you don't even need to open the door. You just walk right in. And now some people's homes, some people actually have them in their homes. Like the kid's bedroom is also a bomb shelter, but it's decorated in a way that you can't really tell. But just the walls are thicker. Some buildings, you have to go all the way downstairs. And these are usually low rise buildings. You might live on the third floor. You got to go all the way down. I'm fortunate in mine. I don't have to go down. So I get 90 seconds, which actually is pretty good. Like in 90 seconds, you can put on your shoes, pick up your keys, do what you need to do. But in the South, in places like Sderot, because they're closer to Gaza, they only have about 15 seconds. That's 1-5.
I mean,
and in 15 seconds, well, the toughest thing, and this is literally happened, is that, you know, like if you're a parent and you got your kids playing in the yard and one of them's like over here and the other one's over there,
you
got
to pick a 15 favorite.
Seconds. Yeah. 15 seconds, enough time for you to pick one kid.
Yeah.
If your kids aren't old enough to run over by themselves or to know, you know, what to do. So I actually feel, you know, very fortunate to be in a place where I've got it right on my floor. Got 90 seconds to get there. You meet your neighbors. We get to talk to each other a little bit. You meet the dogs. Sometimes you make some jokes and make light of it, you know. But when you're making the jokes, you're kind of really just hiding the fact that you don't feel so humorous. But you make jokes anyway, just to kind of lighten the mood. And you guys should be there. We could use an ass.
I would bring my dog. She would be great.
I was going to ask Cap, which kid would you pick?
Well, Ruby wouldn't want to walk. That's a lot of walking. A 90-second walk, she'd be like, "I'm out. I'm not walking that far. I'll take my chances."
Ruby Kaplan wouldn't walk.
Yeah, it's too far. But my dog, I'd carry. She would be a great therapy dog for people. But are you saying? I have one question. You said every building's required to have a bomb shelter. Is that the whole country, or is it by municipality? Or
no, every country, every building's required to have a bomb shelter.
My brother
shelter.
Says his building doesn't have one, and he's in Jerusalem.
It might be an old building before they started. Okay. Yeah.
Get a lawyer.
So if you're in an old building that doesn't have one, what you got to do is go stand in the stairwell, because structurally it's a little bit sounder. And basically the idea is you're really not thinking about a direct hit, because in a direct hit, like, there might not be much you can do. But shrapnel is like a direct hit is in one spot, but shrapnel spreads out everywhere.
Yeah.
And so that's really your statistical chances of being in the way of shrapnel are a lot higher. But also it's more possible to protect against shrapnel with some thick walls.
And what you said that it the way this system's set up, it can detect, is it within a few square blocks or a few square miles, or how accurate? Like if the siren goes off, and also when you initially said sirens, I didn't realize you mean there's a specific sound of a siren that means it's, a missile.
Right.
Coming.
It's not an ambulance siren.
Not an ambulance, not another thing. It's a siren. How, when you hear that, do you know this is within a half a mile, or this is within, like, how close?
Yeah. Well, first of all, if you hear it at all, you know that you go to the bomb. You don't start thinking, oh, is this really for my area? Or is it for another? Like, if it's close enough for you to hear it, you go. And it's basically in terms of like parts of the city. So like the New York equivalent might be, you know, Upper East Side, downtown Wall Street, or Midtown Wall Street, Upper East Side. Like that's about the size
distinction there. That's pretty detailed.
Yeah.
Like pretty specific.
Yeah. They do pretty well with that. I mean, they can't be completely accurate because, you know, they're ballistic objects. They get, you know, wind affects them. Other things can affect them. So you can't tell exactly, but you can calculate the trajectory. And the sound is distinct, but the weird thing is the beginning of this, like it starts with a low sound because the thing revs up and goes, like kind of like that. And the beginning of it sounds very similar to the sound of like a motorcycle revving up. Mm. And so what'll happen is for like a couple months after something like this, every time you hear a motorcycle speeding up, everybody stops and looks around.
Yeah.
Sure. But you know, when I send you my video, you guys you'll hear the siren in the background. You get a sense of what that sounds like.
And what about, so we've been seeing this, I'm sure, I know you guys have all known about this a very long time and you've lived with it. But I think a lot of the world is starting to learn about this Iron Dome, which is I've seen these like videos are insane to see on TV of these missiles flying into Tel Aviv and then exploding in midair. And
yeah,
it's the Israeli military kind of intercepts the missile in air on, while the missile's on the way into attack, and an Israeli missile will fly into the air and knock it out of the air. How, what's it like to live with just in walking down the street and missiles exploding over your head? Or is that the way, or am I describing it incorrectly?
Well, yeah, I mean, it literally is. It's like hitting a bullet with another bullet. It's insane the kind of tech that goes into that. And, you know, during the Gulf War in 1991, America had said to Israel, all right, don't go attacking Saddam Hussein. We got you. And they sent the over batteries of the Patriot. Yeah. But it didn't work.
It didn't work. Yeah,
that's
Patriot
the problem.
The Patriot
the
missile
just kept landing everywhere. Yeah. But yeah, the Patriot missile was that concept of knocking down a missile with another missile. But it didn't work. And but the tech has gotten better since then. So, you know, you're not supposed to be standing around looking at this happening, because if you are, it means you're not in the bomb shelter. And the Iron Dome isn't 100%. Partly just because no tech is, but also partly because if you fire, sometimes they'll fire like 50 rockets at once.
Right. It'll take out 48 of them or something, or what?
It'll take out like 48, but it can't get all of them. You know, the figure I heard is that every Iron Dome missile, because these are like smart missiles that are designed to like pinpoint hit these rockets, costs like $10,000. And just to give you a sense, the last count I heard, which I think is already old news, I think it's gotten higher, but the last count I heard is that in the last week, Hamas had fired like 6,000 rockets at Israel. I think it's even more by now. So you multiply 6,000 by 10,000 Iron Dome rockets, like that gives you a sense, like the costs add up really fast. But you can overwhelm the system. And that's why there was some stories in years past of like, you know, some idiots like decide they're going to stand out on their rooftop and use their phones to take a picture of the Iron Dome doing its thing. And it's like, it's great to have the pictures, but every once in a while, like people like that die because the thing lands on their building and they weren't in their bomb shelter.
You're taking an influencer's taking a selfie of the Iron Dome, and next thing you know, they ain't tell a story.
Yeah, really. So, I mean, it's like, look, you can take chances if you want, but you're really not supposed to. And these days I really don't, I think people are kind of aware of the seriousness now. You don't see too many people hanging around outside taking Iron Dome selfies this time.
How often in your life have you gone into a bomb shelter? Like, does it happen once a month?
I moved to
year?
Israel.
Yeah.
Well, in the last week, I say I've gone in an average of half a dozen times per day for the last week.
Wow.
And since moving to Israel, which is almost 13 years ago, we've had, I think maybe four wars or five wars that involved having to go to the bomb shelter. There was one in 2012, 2014. There were a couple others after. So, you know, in my lifetime, it's probably got to be at least 100 times, I guess.
Yeah. So it's something that happens when wars are... battles flare up, not something that happens just every week of all the time.
No, it's not actually. Yeah. I mean, this is one of these things that I'm always, people ask, you know, is Israel dangerous? And I would like to say to people, well, look, you know, we have normal life, and I'll take a video. And it's like, we're, you know, we got a city here with buildings and people, and, you know, it really is like most of the time it's normal life. I tell you, it was a funny thing. A few years ago, someone asked me, you know, about is Israel safe? And so I did a little bit of math. I looked at the amount of terrorism that took place in Israel in the years 2000 to 2005, which is called the Second Intifada. It was one of these, it was like the worst period in modern Israeli history. And that, and then I compared the total number of deaths from terrorism to the per capita deaths in my original hometown of Chicago during the same period.
Not even close. I'm sure.
Don't do that. Don't do that.
The number of deaths in Chicago from violent, and not deaths from everything, like not like cancer or whatever, but specifically violent crime statistics. And your chances of getting killed on the streets of Chicago are 14 times your chances of getting killed on the streets of Israel from that. Now, that said, at the time, the total number of Israelis who died from terrorism was around like 400 or 500 people a year. And we just had over 1,000 in a single day. So just gives you a sense that this one event is a scale that's different. But it's also like a 9/11 thing. Like over 3,000 people died in America in one day on 9/11. But the next day that didn't happen. Like, so yes. America is not an unsafe place. It had an unsafe day.
Yeah. So how close that first day when you turned on the TV, how close were any of those events to you in Tel Aviv?
Well, that's an interesting question. First of all, Israel's a small country. It's basically like the size of New Jersey. Is that about right, Mike?
That's what they say.
I've read that.
I don't know if that includes.
I'm a Midwest guy, so to me, it's half the size of Lake Michigan. That's how I put it. Hmm. But so nothing is far away. But from an Israeli point of view, when you live in Tel Aviv, you feel like you're an entirely different part of the country than the South, which is where this happened. So physically, it wasn't so close, although obviously rockets came. And since then, they were trying several hundred attacks by land, sea, and air in all different parts of the country, which the IDF thwarted because, just like 9/11, the preparedness went up, you know, very quickly. And they also, Lebanon's been trying to do some incursions in the border in the north. Tel Aviv is right in the center, so I'm not in the north or in the south. But that's how far I was physically. Psychologically, also because it's a small country, everybody knows somebody. Hmm. You know, it's like on 9/11, everyone in New York knew somebody who had died or was somehow affected, but not everyone in America personally knew someone. Here, it's like everyone knows someone who's either gotten killed or captured, and I have friends who've gone to like multiple funerals in the course of just a week. So, and then of course, everybody has that post 9/11 feeling of like, am I safe? Am I not? Are things normal? Are they not? So in that sense, everybody psychologically speaking is pretty close.
Are businesses open in Tel Aviv? Like how do you run a coffee shop if five or six times a day you're running into a bomb shelter, you know?
Well, first of all, you know, I'll answer the question in a second, but you actually can run a coffee shop because coffee shops are in buildings and buildings have bomb shelters. What you can't do is go to, I have a friend who's real into swimming in the sea. He likes open water swimming. He likes to go down to the, you know, Tel Aviv's got a great beach and in the sea. So he was going down there to swim and we were all telling him he's insane. Cause you know, if there's a siren while you're out there swimming, like you can't get to safety. Yeah. Like there's nothing for you to do. So things like beaches and stuff are closed. Coffee shops and restaurants were closed for a few days, but now here and there, I'm seeing them open up. Food stores remained open all the time. In the south, grocery stores were running out of food, but in the center and in the north, they're still getting shipments and they're fine. So
schools
when you
open?
Walk around, what's that?
They keep schools open, stuff like that, or schools closed?
Schools are closed.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing that on a week by week basis. So I don't know what they'll do next. You could have school because schools, you know, have bomb shelters, but you know, corralling all those kids is not, it's a big logistic process, but it's one of these things. It's kind of like COVID in that, you know, you walk out on the street and there's sort of not a lot of people around. And I actually had this weird feeling, like every time I walked into the store to buy food, I felt like I should be putting on my mask.
Right.
Yeah.
Because the street's empty. I'm walking in.
Yeah.
You didn't think you could do it, but you got one out.
Yeah. Got a joke there. Well, I'll tell you, you know, it's also during COVID, like you want to go on a, if you want to go on a date and like COVID, beginning, people weren't going on dates, but when we realized it was going to last for a long time, like, you know, people are human. So dating was like, you'd go to the park because everyone wanted to be outside. So you weren't going to like infect each other. Mm. Well, now you don't want to be in the park because you're not near a shelter, right?
Bomb shelter bedrooms.
You could have a bomb shelter bedroom, or a lot of times people are just like, you know what? I'll just come over to your house. So the funny thing is like, the thing a guy most wants to do on a date, which is trying to find a way to convince the girl to come back to his house. Now it's like the girls are saying, I only want to go to your house. Don't even think about taking me out anywhere.
Hey,
right. And it's just like, all right, then. Mission accomplished.
Bomb shelter boomers. Yeah. To be single this time period.
So, go ahead, Cap, and then we'll take a break.
Oh, no. You should take a break and then we'll move. Yeah. Let's pay the bills.
Are going to take a break. We will be right back in a minute, but we are part of the World's Smartest Podcast Network. Everybody, that is us. That is the Political Orphanage with Andrew Heaton, That is Majoring in Everything podcast with Dr. Andrea Jones-Roy. And that is us, Lost in America. Subscribe to all of our shows. Support all of these shows. I'm going to see Andrew Heaton this weekend in Texas, Kaplan. So right. A little rendezvous.
Is he got a bomb shelter down there?
A little mini pod. Hopefully he doesn't need one.
Yeah.
But by this weekend, who knows? And that is it. And now, ooh, I believe it's a word from us this time, Kaplan. Now, a word from us.
Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you. With professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
All right. Thank you, us.
Thank you, us. Yeah, we're great. That. Paying the bills.
What's funny is that ad will only be in for like 2 months. So if anyone listens to this anytime, or maybe even a month, anytime listens to this in the future, they'll be like, what are you talking about? But whatever. I want to get into, all right, we're back. I want to get into just more of what the kind of a little bit bigger stuff, but what, I mean, I don't know if bigger is the word, but why is anyone talking right now about why this was kind of a surprise, seemingly a surprise to the military? And to the government.
Yeah.
Has that issue come up yet? Failure. Or is it kind of too soon? Is everyone still worried about their own? Is it like first stay alive and then we'll worry about that later?
Well, people are talking about it, but people, you know, we're not really looking for, it's not like there's a commission of inquiry yet. It's not the highest priority isn't to figure out where to point the finger. It's to get safe. I mean, it's definitely on people's minds. And that's also kind of what threw people. It was like, how could it possibly happen? Like, I mean, there's this fence there. The thing is all wired with electronic gear. Like a bird lands on that fence and somebody knows about it, you know? Mm-hmm. So, and it wasn't exactly subtle. I mean, they burst open the fence using Caterpillar like trucks and stuff. And they also, the border crossings, the official ones, they went and blew them up and shot all the guards. Like this was not subtle and it happened in multiple locations. The rumor has it, and, you know, don't quote me on it because it's just rumor now, but, the rumor has it is that there was a cyber, attack, and, the cyber attack was done to disable, Israel's monitoring systems and the systems that get that information to where it's needed. So, and supposedly, Iran was involved in that because Hamas doesn't have that capability, but other. Yeah, but there are other countries that do.
No, I was going to say that's what threw me. It's not just that they got in, but it seemed to me it was like hours went by before like Israel really responded. And we've talked. It's a very small country. It doesn't take 6 hours to get, you know, down to the south. So is that because maybe of a cyber attack or something where they just didn't have the communications to know?
I mean, I'm speaking right now just on the basis of what seems to make sense because nobody's confirming anything yet. And also, you know what, if there was a cyber attack, I don't think at this stage Israel would be wanting to admit that vulnerability just yet. So, I mean, it's like better to seem like someone was asleep at the wheel than to seem like, here's a vulnerability that a nation could exploit.
Have you ever been down? You've been down. I mean, obviously you've been down to the south and Negev, the area, but have you been to the area by the border before? Like, because I've heard that it's like this fence, but, you know, I've never seen, you know, obviously been there myself. So is it as secure as it's, or was supposedly as secure as people have made it out to be?
Well, it's just a fence, you know? Right. I mean, it's a tall fence and it's like a double layered fence. But what makes it secure is not the existence of a thin layer of wire. It's that the whole thing is built with sensory equipment. So, you know, you try to get through that thing. Someone, like I said, a bird lands there and like somebody has to send a unit out to inspect and possibly fight the bird. So that it's secure in the sense that you can get through, but you can't get through with any kind of subtlety.
Right. And like the paragliders and those, I mean, is that just thought of that? Like people were confused by like, what the hell is this going on right now? Like, I mean, normal, are you supposed to be shooting them out of the air? Like what was the, cause that, well, that's, you been know, talked about a lot.
I mean, at the time there was a lot, like, I don't think it never occurred to the IDF that someone could use paraglider. I mean, for that matter, you could use like a pogo stick or something, you know, you could.
But
I think a few things were happening at once. One is they sent a volley of rockets. And I think that's what I heard that morning was part of that initial volley that was meant to distract attention. And also they were breaching in a few different locations at once. And the cyber attack, again, I don't know for sure that there was or for sure that it was Iran, but assuming that's true, I would imagine that they had disabled not only the sensors and the fence, but probably a lot of the communications and the IDF systems so that you could report the information. Probably they disabled some of the radars that would have detected people coming from the air. It's the only explanation I know of that could really fit here.
Yeah, because a lot of conspiracy minded people were getting with the there's no way Israel would allow this. They have such good security. They're doing this as like people were starting to say like a false, you know. And then it's like, but then you see like 1,200 people are dead, and you're like, "There's no way that's the sickest. That would be the sickest conspiracy I can imagine." So there has
Kaplan,
to be
what you're saying, explanation. Just for people who might not follow, because you kind of cut yourself off in the middle of these, is that you're saying that this is something that Israeli government allowed to happen so they could go in and take Gaza?
Well, people have been saying that. Like, they're like, I can't. I've heard multiple people say this to me. Like, how is it even possible that Israel, with this great security, would have allowed this unless they did it intentionally or they ignored some warning intentionally, which is a crazy thing. But like, and that's why the cyber aspect of it, which I haven't heard before, makes a lot of sense.
That's like the George Bush 9/11 crowd.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's that kind of thing. I mean, I haven't heard that conspiracy theory here, but I'm not shocked that, you know, you might be hearing it elsewhere. But the thing is, you know, the people who did this have been saying that this is what they want to do for decades. They've been trying to do it for decades. And now they have what's changed is they have an increasing amount of support from large, sophisticated nation states. And the idea that a nation state that is sufficiently motivated could figure out a way to do this really is not that far-fetched.
Yeah, exactly. It's not just like a bunch, because people here are like stupid. They think it's a bunch of like, they romanticize like, oh, they just like put some paragliders on and flew over. And, you know, it's like it was way more complicated than that, obviously. So, yeah.
When you're saying people, you mean Black Lives Matter of Chicago? Is that who you mean?
I mean, definitely? Idiots we were talking about earlier who are protesting in the streets and are making like they're having their pro Hamas protests where they have the paraglider image as like it's like their symbol of resistance now. Like this was our.
You know, that was Black Lives Matter Chicago. What I found, just to put into context what we were talking about earlier is how small Israel is. I looked it up. You're in Tel Aviv. It's about an hour drive from the border of Gaza. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay.
About right.
An hour south.
I mean, without traffic.
Without traffic. Yeah. And then how far north would be, because Lebanon, now there's Hezbollah is kind of setting up on the border of Lebanon. How far are they to the north of you?
That's a little bit farther. I think it might be closer to like 2 or 3 hours, something like that. Okay, but still not talking large distances by American scale.
Yeah, not large at all. So an hour south, you have one enemy, and two and a half hours north, you have another.
Yeah, and also east to west. It's very at Israel's narrowest point, you could go east to west in like 30 minutes.
Wow.
And then there are points that are wider, but at the narrowest, that's kind of where it is at its narrowest.
What is there any update on the, I know we've heard in the United States that there's U.S. warships are in the sea. Have you guys heard anything about that?
Two aircraft carriers, there's the Gerald Ford and the Eisenhower carrier groups. And also apparently the British have sent some troops. My understanding is that there's a concern about this escalating to other nations. Iran has threatened to enter the fighting, and also Hezbollah, which is the Iranian controlled terror group that essentially controls Lebanon, has already been doing some little things, firing mortars and shots across the border and attempting some incursions. So I think there's an American interest in not wanting this to turn into an entire regional war or a world war. And, you know, bringing an aircraft carrier into the Eastern Mediterranean creates a little bit of deterrence and maybe makes people think twice about trying to escalate in that way.
Yeah.
I think 2,000 troops I saw are Marines are being sent to the area. So,
Israel has always
Go ahead, Dan.
I mean, Israel receives foreign aid from America for the purpose of buying military equipment. Incidentally, all that money by law has to be spent on American manufacturers. So the money all flows back to America. But Israel prides itself on the fact that it has never asked a foreign country to put boots on the ground or risk lives for Israeli interests. And these aircraft carriers are there. I mean, Israel really appreciates it, and it's very touching. But at the same time, they are there for an American interest, which is making sure that the conflict doesn't spread to multiple countries. And Israel still continues to be proud that it's not directly asking anyone else to put boots on the ground for us.
So is that seen as insulting that the United States would put those warships there?
No, it's very much appreciated. But it's not like Americans are going to be like paratrooping into Gaza or something like that.
Yeah,
it's not like Americans are standing here in Tel Aviv guarding the walls with M16s. Like Americans are sort of playing this other role that is potentially beyond Israel's capacity, which is if multiple different countries, you know, we don't know what's happening on a global level. But if Iran is involved, it could involve China, could involve Russia. Like these are things that are beyond Israel's. We think of Israel as being very powerful. Mm-hmm. Israel's very good at defending itself. It's not good at fighting multiple global front warfare kind of things. And so that's really where the US and the Brits are coming in here is to prevent that side from becoming an issue.
Yeah. And I mean, it does seem like Israel can, I think it's an understatement to say handle itself in terms of Gaza, and will be doing that. Is currently doing that and will be in the next few weeks, which brings up a question. What, and if you don't know the answer, that's fine. If this is a question for the government, but what does a victory in this war for Israel look like?
Yeah.
Well, I can tell you what I know is that the government has officially declared the strategic goal of eliminating the Hamas organization, which is notable because for something like 20 years, almost 17 years, Hamas has been in power, and there have been a number of wars or sub-wars, we call them operations, since then. And in none of those cases did Israel ever declare that as a goal. And these things always end. The goal was always to restore calm, to achieve a ceasefire, that sort of thing, and or to restore deterrence. That was always the stated goal before. And the result is that Hamas has stayed in power for this long. And in retrospect, it may have been a mistake, because they had a lot of time to grow and to arm, and it may have sent the message that there are certain things Hamas can get away with and not have to worry about its own existence. And Hamas, you know, it's not great to live under Hamas. I mean, I do not envy Palestinians in Gaza at all. It's sort of like, you know, when the coalition forces attacked ISIS in Syria, no one was being like, oh no, we're bombing Syria. People were like, thank goodness we're finally getting ISIS out of Syria, because they're not good for the Syrians as well as, you know, for anyone else. And that's, there are on the one hand, a lot of Palestinians who support Hamas, but there are a lot who don't. And even the ones who do support them suffer tremendously under them. And so this campaign right now is about getting Hamas out of power. But that does bring up a question is, you know, what happens on day two after this is over? I don't think Israel has a desire to. I think it would be a disaster for Israel to occupy Gaza. And it would be also a disaster for Israel to not occupy Gaza, because then who will? And I've heard some rumors, and I don't have, again, this is, you know, I don't have a solid basis for this, but I've heard rumors that there were some discussions about maybe creating a multi-country presence there that would include like Jordan and Saudi Arabia and Qatar and others who would sort of jointly manage Gaza. And then you would have an actual national leader and a government that you could turn to. And these countries all have relationships with the United States. So when there's problems or someone you could talk to that. So that's one thought that might be out there. But definitely, you know, you think about Iraq. I mean, Saddam Hussein was no picnic for anybody. But it's sort of like the one thing worse than Saddam Hussein was not Saddam Hussein, because then they had everything else, including ISIS.
Well, you have either an occupation, I guess a United States staying long term, or if you want to go to Afghanistan, the second we leave, then it's a power vacuum and then it's worse than ever.
These are not easy. I mean, you go back to
Palestinian Authority. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, you go back to World War II, we had some success with Japan and Germany, and they've grown to be really effective, successful democracies. But, you know, I don't know. But the thing is, Germany had a history of democracy before then. And so there was something to build on. And Japan had an emperor. And once the emperor made the decision, yeah, we're going this direction, everyone kind of followed suit. The Middle East is a little more chaotic and doesn't have that tradition of democracy to build on.
And I was going to ask, though, the Fatah is the Palestinian Authority, the other, right? They control the West Bank, from lack of a... They have no presence in Gaza, or they just don't have any...
No, they used, officially, prior to 2007, they controlled the West Bank and Gaza. In 2005, Israel pulled out of Gaza. I don't know if everyone knows this. There's no occupation in Gaza. There's no Israeli people. There's no Israeli homes. There's no Israeli troops. There's not even like any Jews in Gaza. They pulled everything out in 2005. Then in 2007, once there was no security, Israeli security presence there, Hamas had won a number of seats in the Palestinian parliament. So they were a popular party. They had a majority, but it didn't mean they had 100%. So then they started trying to kill everybody in the opposition party. And Fatah was also doing that too. And what happened was, in the West Bank, Fatah killed most of the Hamas people. And in Gaza, Hamas killed most of the Fatah people. So that left the PA and Fatah in charge of the West Bank, and it left Hamas in charge of Gaza. But now we're post-election. Now it was an election plus a bunch of murder, resulting in just a dictatorship.
It was a 16-year ago election, and they have not had an election since then, right?
And they haven't had elections since, and that's so that was 2007, and Hamas has been in control there since then, and
are they still counting
there.
The votes, or why not?
There's still there's no, and there's no other party. I mean, not to get too into the Palestinian, like, there's nobody else who can step into the power vacuum, I guess, once Israel kills all of Hamas. And
well, it depends what you mean by party. I mean, there's Palestinian Islamic Jihad. There's the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades. There's the Popular Front for the Liberation of. Yeah, I mean, there's groups like that.
Is there there's no Green Party? No libertarians?
Yeah.
Democratic Socialists Party of America?
That's the Popular Front for now.
They could probably get in.
So I guess when I was going to, like, people in the, to say to what Turner was saying earlier, like if you're in the bomb shelter talking about this with people, are they like, do people expect Israel to really eliminate all of Hamas, or is it kind of like we're going to get most of the main leaders and show some sort of victory, but then pull out kind of expectation?
I think the expectation now is that it should be something like Al-Qaeda. I mean, I guess technically somewhere in the world, there's some tiny pockets of people who claim to be Al-Qaeda, but as an organization that essentially doesn't exist, it has no ability to act anymore. And that is my impression of the goal of Israel, to get to the point where, as an actor on the political stage, and military stage, they no longer exist.
And what about the leaders? Like, everyone keeps talking about that guy in Qatar, who's sitting in a
ridiculous.
He's sitting in an ivory tower somewhere, going on TV every day, and he's the leader of Hamas.
And this is global day of rage.
Go nuts. I mean, shouldn't he be dead? Probably. Is that an outlandish statement?
Well, I'll tell you what. It's a funny thing. At first, Hamas was bragging about this. They were proud of it. They were videoing it and sending the videos all over the world. You know, this was the largest loss of Jewish life in a single day since the Holocaust. And much like the Holocaust, they were proud of it. Then they realized that not everybody loves death as much as they did, which apparently came as a shock to them. And so now their leadership abroad is turning back and saying, oh, it was all Photoshop. They used AI to make it look like it happened. It was never really real. And it was
a comedian share that video. Like, I somebody on the left like thinks that's true. They said the IDF actually killed most of the hostages. The people.
Wait, who said that?
I don't remember their name. I'll have to find. I don't remember.
You do.
I actually don't. But I was going through our. You know, I see all these crazy people posting things on Instagram, and somebody posted something that said,
"Does their name start with an EL at the beginning?"
No, it might have been her, but the IDF is a plan. It's AI. Yeah. This is all these crazy theories people believe because they realize that, oh, wait, we don't get, except for on some college campuses and with some idiot comedians, people don't have sympathy for, you know, murdering 1200 people. So,
yeah. See, but that's the thing. In the first couple of days, they didn't realize that yet.
No.
So for a couple of days, they were like, hearing about it and then suddenly not.
It was like
your question.
It was like when remember after Will Smith punched Chris Rock at the Oscars, and then Will Smith went out and celebrated that night, and he was like, "Yeah, punched him." And he was getting standing ovations at the Oscars. They gave him a full standing ovation. And then it wasn't until the next day when he went on Twitter and he was like, "Oh, most of the world was against this." And then he apologized. Anyway, that's my analogy.
It's like, how do you not realize that? So, but to answer your question, Turner, there are Hamas leaders in Qatar and other places too. The thing is, you know, I don't think Israel at this moment wants to open an entire front with Qatar. And I mean, that would be, you know, it would be another front, and it would be going to war against a well-equipped country. But Israel has acted in other countries before. There was a number of years ago, they killed some Hamas guys in the Emirates, in Dubai, who were off there doing an arms deal. And then obviously we all remember Adolf Eichmann, who got kidnapped in Argentina. He was the Nazi who hadn't been brought to justice by the rest of the world. So Israel kidnapped him in Argentina and brought him to trial. So it's not out of the question that Israel might do something like that at some point, but it raises so many question marks, including what kind of role Israel wants Qatar to be playing here. If they're looking for them to be one of the powers that is managing Gaza afterwards, and maybe they want to keep good relationships. It's just too many question marks.
Why don't we just threaten they don't get any more World Cups? Let's start with that.
Yeah.
Qatar, since they just hosted one.
I mean, they didn't allow beer. Yeah. They shouldn't get another one anyway.
Yeah. And was that Hamas guy at the games? I don't remember, but no.
He was sober. Yeah. So it wasn't bad.
Qatar's,
he wasn't drinking beer. Yeah.
Qatar has been funding Hamas for a long time. And even when the World Cup was going on, I was a little bit like, oh my God, it's one of these, like, that's not going to age well moments, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What about, so you brought up a good point that the world didn't like violence as much as they had hoped. In Hamas. And so now the global media is starting to show more and more of what's, you know, Gaza and children being carrying out of buildings and all that stuff. At what point does the Israeli community and government care that the world is seeing this? Maybe it's like, we don't care what the global how the opinions sway worldwide. We need to take care of this. We need to take care of this problem for us. Or is their thought like, well, we need to get ahead of this with the, I guess, PR or somehow think about the death of innocent people as we're going in and getting Hamas.
Yeah, it's a difficult thing because, you know, Hamas for decades has been integrating its military machine into the civilian infrastructure. And so there are rocket launchers literally in children's bedrooms, and there's command and control literally in schools and in mosques. So it's very difficult to operate there in a way that's absolutely surgical. And it's sort of a Sophie's choice. Like, if you blow up this rocket launcher, it could harm some civilians. If you don't blow up this rocket launcher, it keeps firing at Israeli civilians. And those are civilians too. Mm-hmm. And then there's another issue, which is about 20 to 30% of Hamas's rockets misfire and land in Gaza, and that kills civilians.
Right.
And also Hamas puts out, they don't always distinguish between fighters and civilians when they put out their figures. And another thing is, you know, Israel issues warnings before attacks, which most countries don't do. And one of the warnings they gave is that people should evacuate Gaza City. And Hamas has been forcing people to stay there. And they've even there have even been some explosions along the evacuation route that did not come from the IDF. So when you see these stories, it's a human tragedy, but it's not necessarily for certain that Israel is the causative force there. Nonetheless, it is a public relation. Even if Israel didn't do it, or even if Israel did it under circumstances that were unavoidable, it's still a public relations issue that Israel has to address. And I think, you know, that's sort of what I'm here for. I come from America. I speak not only English, but I speak American, which is to say the cultural language. I can advise Israelis on, like, yeah, don't say that. That would be a great thing to say in the Arab world. Mm. And it would make sense to an Arab ear. It would not be a good thing to say to Americans. And so I've been working as hard as I can to try and get Israelis to see why my advice has value. And believe it or not, this time they are beginning to listen. So hopefully we'll see some good.
What's an example of that? Or would that be the opposite of doing your job to give us an example? But I would love to hear.
I can give you an example of something that that they didn't consult me on, which was the energy minister said that we are not going to let any humanitarian aid, not one drop of water, not one bit of electricity or food in until after the hostages are released. And to an Arab ear, that sounds strong. It sounds confident. It sounds like you're dealing with someone who knows what they're doing. And it actually increases the chances of getting hostages released because it's a cultural language that's understood. But to an American ear, that just sounds like you're trying to. It sounds like collective punishment. And there are other ways to very legitimately state that. One of which is you could say we can't take care of only Palestinian civilians and not Israeli civilians. Also, let's do this in tandem and not just do one or the other because Israeli civilians are there. Another thing he could have said is that Hamas has so thoroughly integrated itself that it's not possible to move humanitarian aid in without it going to Hamas. So we need the world to help us find a way to make sure these resources don't go to helping attack us. He also could have mentioned that Hamas's water system, they dug up the pipes to turn them into rockets.
I've seen those videos. Yeah,
the crossings that used to have hundreds of trucks of humanitarian aid going through every day have all been blown up as part of the October 7th attacks. Hamas blew them up. So now we don't have a secure way to move things through because Hamas eliminated that way. So there are all these sorts of things he could have said that would have made sense to Americans. And that's sort of where I feel I can play an important role is I'm not changing the reality of the message, but I'm just making sure they talk about the points that Americans care about.
Yeah. And I've always said, despite we have all of our best as Jews, best publicists, I think in Hollywood, because the state of Israel has always had a terrible PR. They've for years been releasing, not handling things the best way. And so I'm glad that Dan is there talking some sense to them. Cause it is like, in all seriousness, I was saying this to Turner last night, you know, as Jews, we're kind of trained that like, oh, CNN don't always trust how they cover Israel. CNN and all those media channels have been just fantastic on this so far because this story is just that awful. Like they have, like there's no other side. And so Israel would be wise to, while they need to go into Hamas and go into Gaza and do the business, to be mindful of that because you don't want to turn the popular opinion in the world against Israel if you can help it.
Everybody loves a victim. And Israel for that moment was a victim. But it is going to get even early on, though, I heard some of the mainstream outlets saying things like there have been over 1,000 deaths on both sides. When at the time, the number of deaths in Gaza were like a dozen people and they were all fighters.
It's like, I think it's gotten better as it's gone on, as they realized how bad it was. I think that
the public opinion.
I see. Yeah.
Those polls that showed because the 6% of people in America who did celebrate the death of 1,200 Israelis. Well, what you find is they're very loud online, but they're a very small minority of American actual human beings. And so I think once the mainstream, I think the media in this case sort of followed the lead of the people. Once they realized that's where the sentiment was, they kind of went with that. Cause MSNBC, who's very left. And by the way, Dan, I don't know if this news is making it through over there, or if you even care, or if any, or they shouldn't. But a lot of that, most of that 6% is on the far left of the United States political spectrum. Which typically the far left is the compassionate side is where they kind of see themselves, but not in this case. So I think with MSNBC is even not. Which is left. They're left wing. They're also showing a pretty fair side of all this stuff. I did have a question, which might be very. It might be a very dumb question. I'm sure it is to you, but so I have been reading, as you said, that they're cutting off the water, and something else. Is it electricity supply or something like that to Gaza?
Well, they're not. The thing is, Gaza never built its own power plants. It diverted foreign aid money to.
That's my question. Terrorism. Why doesn't Gaza have it? If Hamas has been in charge since 2006, that's enough time to set up your own water system and electricity system. I mean, I'm not an expert on either one of those, but I would think you could set it up so you're not reliant on the essentially enemy country to supply you with this stuff.
Yeah.
You believe it just shouldn't exist country.
Well, there was a video photo that I saw from a number of years ago where the electrical plant in Israel that supplies Gaza had taken some damage from a Hamas rocket. And so Israeli electrical workers were on the roof of that building trying to fix it. And while they were working, Hamas was firing at them, at the people who were trying to provide electricity to Gaza. So that's the sort of weirdness that's going on here. And it's because Hamas's only path toward good PR is to show victimhood. And so if they can make sure that electricity stays cut off, they're going to find a way to do that.
Sure. It's kind of like, I remember that, to another parallel, Fidel Castro always wanted the embargo. The embargo was like the best thing for Castro.
It was great for him. Yeah.
Because he could stay in power as long as everyone blamed America and didn't blame him for the problem. If the embargo would have.
Yeah. It kind of sucks if you're anyone other than Castro though, right? Anyone.
Of course, the embargo was awful for the Cuban people, but it was great for him personally. Go ahead, Kev.
Yeah, no, I was just going to change gears a little bit and just ask you, do you have any, I mean, people you know who have been called up for the reserves, who have gone down, have you heard any reports back from
people who are? Yeah, almost everybody. I mean, almost everybody who does reserves duty right now has been called up. It's, I know a lot of people have been called. I know a lot of people whose, you know, family members are there. And so, you know, they're feeling worried. I have friends who've been called up who are combat soldiers. I have other friends who are in intelligence units. Crazy thing that happened, the call up was so massive and so fast that the logistics units couldn't keep up with it. And so you had soldiers out in the field who like didn't have food because they hadn't gotten it out. The logistics unit hadn't gotten the food there yet. And we've been, you know, there's all these reports about how, you know, the IDF doesn't have equipment. And that's actually not true. There are individual soldiers who don't have equipment, but the IDF itself has it. They just haven't gotten everything to wear out into the field just yet. But it is a huge call up. I mean, if you think about like, right, I think the call up has been about 300,000 right now. Plus they have about 150,000 regular army. I mean, that's fully 5% of the population of Israel.
So if you're a citizen, everybody we know serves in the military, and then you join the reserves. How does this work? And you have to answer the call if you get it when you're.
Well, not everybody does reserves. It depends on whether your particular skill is likely to be needed after you finish your regular service. And
if it was me, they wouldn't put me in the reserves. I got no skill, but yeah.
It also depends on age. You know, after a certain age, they don't want you in reserves anymore unless you're a career soldier who's become like a senior commander. But everybody who is of reserves age and who is in an area that they would actually need, almost all those people are being called up. And I think the reserve age goes to about 40 or 45, something like that.
I don't think they would have wanted a 25-year-old Kaplan either, though.
No, I think Dan knew me at that age.
No matter what age. I did hear, Cap, you should tell your daughter this, Ruby, that Taylor Swift's bodyguard flew back.
I saw that. So there you go. He's used to dealing. If there's any Palestinians who are just trying to like get close to people for autographs.
Now, do you think these people will be protesting outside of Taylor Swift concerts?
She didn't. No, that's a good question. Do the reservists train during the how does that work even? Because like I know a lot of people in America who just got on a plane and they had to go buy their own tickets, I guess. And there was people who were raising money for that. And it's a crazy thing to me that you just leave your life and go back to fight. But
yeah, people feel a really strong connection. It's funny. There were some Israelis who were like looking for flights to get out and rushing to leave the country, especially ones who had small kids. But there were even more Israelis who were rushing to get in and trying to find a flight and can't afford a ticket. Who can help pay for my ticket? That sort of thing. But training, reservists, you know, first you do your regular service for women, it's 2 years, for men, it's 3 years. Oh, I think recently they changed it so that for women it's now 2.5 years. But if you're in some special unit, it might be more years because you need more training before you're even competent to work in that unit. And after that, people do reserves depending on what your job is. It could be a couple weeks a year or something like that. Or maybe a few times a year for a week or 2 weeks each. And then like once every two or three years, you might have a larger call up for like a month and a half. And they do that partly to keep you trained so that you don't lose the skills, and partly because there may be a need. Like they need, even not in wartime, they supplement the regular army for like patrols or lookouts or whatever. And so my friends who are in reservists, you know, I remember them being called up frequently from time to time. And, you know, I used to be the CEO of a company with a pretty large staff. And one of our guys was a combat soldier, really soft-spoken, thoughtful, sweet guy, graphic designer. And they called him up. You know, I remember every year there would be a couple times when he got called up and we had to make sure to shift all his work to other people. But now, and usually these call-ups, like, you know about it weeks in advance and you tell your employer and you get ready. But this obviously was a very quick call-up.
So yeah, I would just be a very valuable employee, is what you're saying, because they would never call me up. So
exactly.
That's when I would go in for the job interviews. I'd say, I'll never be called up. Don't worry about it. Hire me.
Well, it's a funny thing about the Israeli army because, you know, basically everybody serves. There are some exceptions if you're like really religious or if you have some medical issue or whatever, but basically everyone serves. And they find something for everyone. And, you know, I did some volunteering as a civilian volunteer, you know, so I wasn't officially a soldier, but I was on the base. They gave me a uniform and I helped out wherever I could. So I didn't do basic training, but I mostly helped with logistics. So I was packing medical supplies and I had other bases where I was packing the kit bags for the soldiers when they have an emergency.
Did you pack lunches?
You know, I never actually did kitchen duty. But
Kaplan could make many hot dogs.
But, you know, if they,
I was offered that. I almost volunteered to do that like 20 years ago. And the guy's like, you know, you clean the Uzis, you pack lunches, and it sounded so emasculating. Yeah. But now that I pack my kids' lunches every single morning, I'm a pro. I should go to Israel and start packing some lunches.
Yeah, you're a pro. Well, and I'll tell you what, you could make light of it, but the fact is, if you send 300,000 soldiers to the middle of the desert without food, you got yourself a problem. And suddenly Kaplan, the guy packing lunches becomes pretty important.
There you go.
They got to eat. Yeah. I have a question. I remember, you know, when we first started talking, when I first met you, you were running Playboy magazine over there in Israel.
That's right. I was with you guys in person in the studio in New York.
Yes. Oh, yeah. And I wonder, you know, Playboy's been in the news in the past couple of weeks for denouncing Mia Khalifa. Did you have anything to do with that statement?
Oh, yes. And I
wish I could take credit for that. But good for them. You know, Playboy's undergone a lot of changes since I was there. Almost all the people I know who were part of the organization at that time, this is already 10 years ago, have moved on to other things, and they've tried to rebrand and do different things. They tried to go woke for a while. I think they tried putting a trans person on the cover. They tried going non-nude. They've been trying all sorts of things. And
trans.
So I've been a little bit out of touch with the inner workings of,
There was a trans Playboy magazine issue.
Yeah, no, I mean, not the whole magazine, but they had a trans model that, you know, and it's a whole different concept. I think they had this idea that, you know, maybe if they went that direction, it would tap into the woke crowd, and then didn't really work.
Woke people are not buying those. Well, if they are, they're not telling people. Yeah, that's not why they get the magazine.
But I feel like that's already a genre of magazine, isn't it? Like
what?
Trans magazines. Yes,
yeah, like the whole thing.
I get canceled saying it that way, but yeah.
Whatever the term.
Yeah, you guys are flirting with cancellation here.
You should drop some Playboy magazines to the troops, and that should be part of your...
I tell you what, no joke, in 2014, I did exactly that. And I sent it with one request that if you get a magazine, send me a selfie of yourself, you know, holding it up. And I had these great pictures of guys like sitting on top of their tanks, holding the magazine with a big smile and stuff.
That's cool. Yeah.
Send
some Playgirl magazines for the female troops. And there you go.
Support the troops. Yeah.
I can't believe I have a question. I don't know if we got to it, but has there been any update? We were about, because Hamas took the hostages, right? And we all kind of assumed they were going to ask for prisoners. But now they're kind of saying, like, just stop shooting at us and we'll...
Oh, yeah. What do they want?
What's their plan B?
Yeah. What's step two of their plan?
You know, it's not 100% clear what they're thinking, but I'll give you my guess based on history. You remember the story of Gilad Shalit, or you might, if you don't, I'll tell you. About 10 years ago or so, a young soldier named Gilad Shalit got captured right by the border with Gaza, and they brought him in and they kidnapped him. They held him for, I think it was several years. And eventually Bibi, who was prime minister at the time, negotiated a deal to get him released. And it was in exchange for something like 1,000 prisoners, many of them who were security prisoners. And in fact, I heard a statement, I can't confirm this, that apparently most of the high ranking people who planned this October 7th attack were people who had gotten released in that deal, which has got to make you think Gilad has got to be feeling awful right now and a poor guy because it's not his fault. But I think it created this idea in the mind of Hamas that if you can get prisoners, you can stop Israel in its tracks and Israel will do anything at all. And so I think their thinking probably was, we're going to pull this thing off. We're going to get a bunch of captives. Israel's going to want to respond and maybe they'll shoot for a couple of days, but then they're going to get to negotiations and we'll end up still in power and maybe even in a better position because we'll negotiate getting some of our people released. And I think that certainly is not the mood of the Israeli public right now. And I think Hamas is beginning to realize that they may have miscalculated.
Yeah. I mean, because like, correct me if I'm wrong, because Netanyahu is obviously this a right-wing figure. He's been around forever, but he's never really wanted to go into Gaza, right? He's never been very comfortable with the idea of they're going in now and they're not settling for just, I don't know. What are they do they think they'll release all these prisoners that are still left? Like, is that the actual, you think, goal? Or?
The goal is that what happened should never happen again.
Yeah.
And the first step toward achieving that goal is getting Hamas out of any sort of operational position to destroy it as a functioning organization. That's the primary goal. In terms of getting prisoners out, I'm sure if they could figure out a way to release them using special forces, that would be ideal. Then after that, there's negotiations, but negotiations could result in a situation where a greater threat remains for Israel for the future. So it's kind of not clear what's going to happen here. And obviously, I'm not one of those people who knows if Israel knows where they are or if Israel has a plan to get them. That's beyond my pay grade. So I don't even have to sit here and say I could tell you, but then I'd have to kill you. I couldn't even tell you.
But they don't have a lot of intelligence in Gaza, right? Because they pulled everyone out. So it's not like to be able to know where they are. I assume they would.
They have, they recruit spies just like any country does anywhere in the world. And then there's signals intelligence where they're listening in on things. And then, they have satellites and drones and underground seismographs and, all the things that every country does in different places. So they've got something, but whether it's Gilad Shalit, in years they weren't able to find him.
Right.
Of course, the tech has gotten better since then. So, who knows?
Awful. Who knows?
Well, Dan, I think that is it. Thank you for joining the show, my friend. And Kaplan, what's up? You got more?
I was going to ask him, do you have any organizations you would recommend for people to donate to as far as who want to support a humanitarian aid or...
Well, it's all a question of what you're interested in. If you are interested in Israel's image in the world, I can tell you our organization, Reality Check, is a 501c3 nonprofit, tax deductible, and Israel urgently needs us now, and we're doing amazing work. If you're into supporting MADA, which is Magen David Adom, they provide emergency services. There are a whole wide variety of charities related to the IDF. It's really a question of what is a priority for you and what you'd like to help support. But also I'd like to say, first of all, I want to thank you guys for giving me the opportunity to laugh a little bit today, because it's something that my soul needed and all of our souls need. But I don't want anyone out there to think that I'm making light of what happened. This is a serious situation. It affects us all the time. I spend most of my day really feeling the heavy weight of this. And just, thank you guys for giving me 1 hour to be able to just smile a little bit.
Well, thank you, Dan. And we're on the same page. We're just trying to get through this. We've been doing our Patreon comedy show over the past, couple weeks or week or so. And we've been saying the same thing in the air. We're going to be making jokes. These might not be about this. We're trying to escape. We're trying to just get through this any way we can. The way we know how to is to try to be funny. And everyone needs to cope in their own way and get through it in their own way. And you're the one in the middle of it. So thank you for joining us.
Yeah.
I've been telling my kids, I was telling them, this is exactly how I you know, they were asking me about 9/11 recently with the anniversary and what did you feel like? And I was saying this past week, plus this is exactly how I felt with 9/11.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
our thoughts are with you over there.
Thanks, man.
Yeah. And all, hopefully, you know, everyone, gets through this as peacefully as possible. Everybody check out Dan Reality Check Research. You can follow him on Instagram at Daniel Speaks Up. Excuse me, realitycheckresearch.org. Okay, cool. And yes. It's org. Yeah, there you go. 501c3. Get your tax there deductions. And
get those deductions, people.
Yeah, Daniel Speaks Up on Instagram.
Exactly. Yeah, Daniel Speaks Up on Instagram. I put stuff up as often as I can.
And that's it. Kaplan, what should we do?
I'm Yisrael Chai. Get lost.
Get lost.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.